Welcome to Packet Pushers, the data networking podcast, where real engineers get together to dissect and review the work life in the networking industry. This week, I've packed up the virtual workbench and dragged it down in a little carry case behind me on the train to London, and I'm ensconced in a decidedly second-rate hotel where I wouldn't regard it with stars. I'd probably rate it as to how many fleas it has. But notwithstanding, we're going to gather it around it, and we've got a monstrous cast of thousands, starting with the person who's put in the biggest effort to be here, Kurt Bales. How are you this week?
Good this week. Sat my JNCIE lab on Monday, walked out with a few bruises after that, and told I have to wait a week or two before they even start to mark the results. Yeah, it's a long wait.
Did you get it handed to you, do you think, or are you going to have to loop around for another run?
Pretty sure I'm going to have to sit it again when they offer it in Sydney again in December, but I'm hopeful. There's 0.1% chance.
Fair enough. And also with us this week is Jeff Rye. How are you, Jeff? Long time no here.
Yeah, I'm doing good. Surviving, just dealing with a lot of DMVPN posting.
Yeah, I saw that. You know, I've got some questions for you later on in the show about Nexus 2000s, because I think you've worked on those little boxes of evil.
Yeah, it's been a while.
And also with us this week, after a long, long hiatus, after shifting jobs and suddenly deciding that management is almost better than engineering, is Josh O'Brien. How are you, Josh? What have you been doing?
I've actually been on holiday all week out in North Carolina, which actually means I've just been working a lot harder and from phone while my family enjoys their breaks.
So this new job's working out all right then?
Yeah, loving the new job, and I would not say management is better than engineering, but I can say that doing both management and engineering is one of the most complicated things I've done at the same time ever before, but it's good stuff.
Enjoying it. I see you talking a lot about call centers and voice. That sounds like my kind of idea of torture.
Interesting. You guys pretty much all know that I hate voice. Coming into this job, I thought I was fixing a route switch issue and then hiring a bunch of experts in voice, and then I got into the call center space to find out that there is no such thing as a true video call center. So I'm spending most of my time bludgeoning vendors to try to prove to me that they can do what they say they can do, and so far everybody's fallen on their face. It's great stuff right now.
And reprising his role from previous week is Tom Muffin Top Hollingsworth. How are you, mate?
Oh, I'm wonderful this week. The heat's finally come down. We're only down to 105 outside every day, so I'm enjoying the nice, cool data center where I'm working on blades and other stuff.
And as returning to us as one of our most popular characters on the show, and she is, as we all know, running by the handle of only the pseudonym Mrs. Y. What have you been doing this week, Mrs. Y?
Sorted things at work having to do with VPN problems because of the new version of OS X Lion. And trying to filter through all the DEF CON Black Hat news to figure out which is overblown and which is the stuff that you need to be worried about.
I think everything that's come out of Black Hat basically tells me that everybody's been compromised, we just don't know it.
You and RSA.
And finally, and last, but the very not least, is Mr. Ethan Banks. Welcome back.
Hey, Greg. I am turning into firewall guy, it would seem. A lot of ASA stuff. I actually ordered a book, a new Cisco Firewalls book that Cisco Press has put out. And then I found myself going up to the CCIE page on Cisco's site, poking around at the security. How big is that blueprint anyway? Maybe I can do this thing again. It's been 3 years, and I don't twitch anymore when I hear that term. Lab. So, maybe. I don't know. I'm starting to think maybe I want to go down that route and be a security guy. Security focused again. I don't know.
I thought I wanted to go down the route to security, but I've been tempted by the data center path. I feel there's a future in data centers, you know?
The fad.
You need something fundamental and structural, like, you know, voice is just like the peas on the side of your plate that you really don't want to eat, you know.
I actually read through the Cisco Live presentation on the data center CCIE track that's coming at some point, and was looking through the storage bits, and that's tempting also for me, for the same reasons that you said. Obviously there's a major future in that. If you get that specialty, that makes a lot of good career sense. But storage is just not something I've spent a lot of time with, so I don't know how big of a hurdle that would be to overcome. But,
yeah. Well, I've spent a lot of time on it lately, and I've realized that Fibre Channel is a protocol designed to emulate a 50-way SCSI cable. So,
how could that be bad?
You know, how could you go wrong? I mean, honestly, it's pretty awesome indeed. Well, before we get kicked off into arguing about various news topics this week, because as you've probably noticed, this is a virtual workbench where we sort of chew over the news and swap nasty stories about vendors. What I wanted to talk about was that Packet Pushers has been had a bit of a facelift this week. We've got a new look. Ethan's been scratching around in some themes work and has rehacked things into shape. And who's typing? Who's typing?
Nobody now.
I love it.
You're on a phone call full of nerds and you ask who's typing?
With me.
It's me. And so Packet Pushers is at an overhaul. This is your opportunity. One of the things that we started Packet Pushers for was to reach out to the community and share stuff with you. For what it's worth, our tiny little brains don't have a whole lot of content in them, and we just tend to keep talking about the same things.
So this is your opportunity to unload your once-a-month piece of writing into a community of people. What we'll do is get you to submit your articles, and we'll get them reviewed by people, put together a bit of a panel. They won't be looking for much except for correct spelling and fundamental accuracy, and then put your stuff up. And the idea would be is that you can express your voice, share some stuff. We want to talk to anybody at any level, so it's not about writing, you know, high-level deep-dive nerding on multicast senders and receivers. It could be about CCNA or CCNP topics, whatever you like, I think, and it is worth sharing with the community. So send an email to packetpushers@gmail.com and tell us that you're interested, and we'll work with you to get that set up. And it's all Ethan's idea, so anything you want to say about that, email him and blame him for it.
Oh, nice. Yeah, what Greg was saying about the, you know, if you're not at a CCIE level and you still got stuff to write about, yeah, do that, because that's what a lot of people are interested in. So don't be shy. If you're interested and want to get out there, just go ahead and do it. Don't feel like, oh, I'm not good enough. It's fine. You know, we're going to help you sanity check any of your documents for technical accuracy and all that as much as we know and can do that. And, yeah, so please don't be shy. We'd love to have everybody's voice included.
So let's push on with the topics for the show this week. I think the first one we should talk about this week is that VMware announced a licensing program a couple of days ago where they did a really lovely gouging program. Oh, sorry, change to their licensing program to see if they could screw an awful lot more money out of their customers. The net result was that they went with a consumption-based licensing scheme, which is effectively they say that by licensing the amount of RAM used by a virtual server, charge according to the RAM that you're using. Theoretically, this is usage-based pricing. Challenge was, however, is that they set the bar very, very low indeed. Most people ended up paying 3, 4 to 10 times more. There was a significant amount of backlash from the customers. Subsequently, they've backed down. Now, this is actually a useful discussion to have because it comes back to the concept of consumption-based licensing, which is one of my favorite topics, because, for example, on a Cisco ASA, when you buy a 10 gigabit interface, it costs just shy of $10,000. Of course, we happen to know that a network interface doesn't cost $10,000, but in the case of a Cisco ASA card, it is actually a license for using more. Does anybody have a particular view on licensing and whether it should be consumption-based or whether it should be just a capital cost that you buy? No.
7 people on this call and no one has an opinion.
Well, see, I firmly believe that when you buy something, you should own it. Right? Do you go out and buy a car and pay for it by the mile that you use it? Because that's what VRAM is on VMware. And that's what usage licensing is on. You know, imagine if you paid per connection or per stateful connection on a firewall. What if you paid per, you know, packet sent through a router? That's a usage-based licensing. The amount of RAM you use in a server is something that is only ever going to increase over time. The amount of packets that cross a router is only going to increase over time. And the amount of firewall rules that you add in a firewall only increases over time. It never gets less. So it's a guaranteed price increase scheme over time.
Well, yeah, you're making a moral objection as far as how the licensing is going as opposed to an economic one. And clearly VMware is making the economic choice. Hey, we see a way that we can grow revenue here. But, I mean, we're already seeing the evidence of a lot of backlash in the virtualization community. People are cranked about this. People have not been happy with this new scheme, and it seems like they've already backed off of just what they're doing and what the limitations are going to be.
Well, they relaxed the limitations. They didn't back off of them completely. I think they had to do this from a revenue perspective because they painted themselves into a corner with socket licensing. back in the day when there was one or at most two cores per server, all you had to do was say, all right, you know, you're going to have a four-processor server. We're just going to license every one of those sockets, and you're going to pay through the nose for it. And then the whiz kids at Intel and AMD said, oh, hey, we can put like 6 or 8 or 10 processors on one die. And so now VMware's revenue model is looking at this going, So now they're making 1U servers with two sockets, so we're only ever going to make two sockets worth of licensing off this server, and they're going to be running 24 cores and Lord knows how much RAM inside of it. And so some genius stood up in a meeting and said, why don't we license RAM? And you know, you can imagine what that probably sounded like. Yeah, yeah, that's a great idea. No one's ever really going to mind that. They'll pay. They'll pay because they have to.
Yeah, but they don't have to. Isn't that part of it?
In other words,
there's alternatives that people are starting to talk about.
Yeah, there are. I mean, I think Microsoft's Hyper-V webpage probably got quadruple the number of normal hits that it ever does. So that's up to, like, what, 8, like the day this was announced? And then I know that some people have started looking at Xen from Citrix and some other alternatives. Just, you know, now it used to be it was the only game in town. And, you know, Oracle proved that when you're the only game in town and you start screwing your customers, oh, look, there are other things you can do.
Well, I think the argument about having other options is interesting because if you look at some of the vendors have decided to not go the VMware route. If you look at Avaya, they do Xen. And you're starting to see a lot of big data center companies in the last couple of months start looking heavily at Xen. I think the challenge is there's not nearly the feature set that exists on VMware that's on Xen or any of the other platforms right now. And there's still a really, really good market, a really good reason to do VMware right now.
I think VMware went about this the whole wrong way because the way that they determined the entitlement caps for their customer base was they looked at all the tech support logs that had been sent in over the course of the last couple of years, and they calculated it. And they said, okay, we're going to say that the 5% who are above this line are the heavy users, and we're going to kind of throw them to the wolves. But everybody else will fit into this. They didn't bother going out to ask all their V-experts, their evangelists, whether or not that this would be a good idea. They didn't bother to go out and ask their customers about this. They just took some information and did it kind of in the back room, and they didn't really get any feedback. And when they finally went live with it, because I think they went live with it the Tuesday that we were at Cisco Live, which was kind of impressive that they finally managed to find a piece of information coming out that could overshadow the layoffs at Cisco, because it's all I could hear about all morning long before the keynote. The customer base just rioted, and so they finally got into damage control mode. They should have done this from the start. They should have said, hey, guys, what would be something that you guys would consider, you know, artificially limiting VMs to this much RAM, pooling it, how would you like to go about it? So even if the decision came down and looks exactly like it did today, at least the customers can go, hey, we had input into this and we got the best deal we could.
So the point that I have is that it's the thin edges for consumption-based licensing, right? If you charge by RAM, or if you're like Cisco charging for SSL VPN by user licenses. So I was looking at the price of a 500-user SSL VPN premium connection license, which was $40,000 at list. So that basically says for the 500 users, you need to pay a $200 license per person. But is it – at least then I own it, right? And then no matter how many more – how and no matter what happens to SSL over time, it doesn't change in that sense. But what does the thing about VMware and VRAM is this year you're using Windows Server 2008, and in Windows Server 2010, it'll be twice the size, use twice as much RAM, and then the silly application like Microsoft SQL Server will use 4 terabytes of RAM because that's the only way it's ever going to run properly, and you've just got to keep coughing up more license. The only thing that happens here is that VMware gets effectively a price rise for doing nothing.
No, I agree, and I think VMware's method of doing it is completely wrong because it's not user-based licensing. User-based licensing, you can't really get around for certain applications because if you were to buy, you know, an SSL ASA and it had 500 SSL licenses built into it, they'd have to put those licenses into the list cost of the device. You'd be paying more up front for capacity you wouldn't use. This stuff is just silly. They need to go back to the way it was in 4 and say, you
it
know
makes
what?
My head so, hurt. I don't even understand it. I don't even understand it. It's like I sat down when I first was reading it. I went, okay, and then you'd read 3 different stories about it, and I couldn't And they all sounded different. The model all sounded different when I started doing the math. I'm like, I don't understand. It's not like checkpoint licensing. You know, here's a server. It takes a license. I mean, it just, I didn't get it.
Let's not hold checkpoint up as an example of anything, please.
Hey, look, I've gotten the spam messages just like everybody else. You go one over that server, or actually they give you that cushion of 5 and you go to 6. But, you know, at least you kind of have a number in your head. This is just, you know, you guys are right. I mean, it's when it's based on something like RAM, I don't even know how to follow that.
You mentioned the meeting where somebody stood up and gave this great idea. I don't think the engineers did. I mean, there's this weird thing that happens because engineers and people develop product. They think it's cool. They want it out in the marketplace, and they want to do really great things with it. It's how VMware's gotten where they are. I mean, I'm working on building products as part of my company and then part of the company that I work for right now. And all the time we're balancing, okay, what do we give away versus what do we recoup cost on? So we know the engineers didn't do this. This is a way to make revenue. So as engineers, what would we be willing to pay for? That becomes the real question. So they've got to make money and innovate somehow. So what are we willing to pay for? Because I don't agree with the RAM methodology either, but I still think VMware is the best product in town. So what would everybody be willing to pay for?
Well, I mean, but that upgrade, I mean, is that really? I mean, they went to NetFlow 5.
You can challenge VMware best in town.
It's a tough call. I mean, it's too late for VMware 5. The product's shipping in like a week, 2 weeks, something like that. We can't fix it now. We can't put it back to 4. And there are features in 5 that are good enough that people are going to want to upgrade. And that's kind of where they painted themselves into a corner. It's not like this was just an evolutionary upgrade that people are like, you know what, I can deal without those two things. Or like, you know, like Greg's post about the horrible attempt that they did at making networking better. My opinion, they didn't want to make it better. They're going to wait and release their own plug-in vSwitch, kind of like the Nexus 1000V, that you have to license separately. So there's more cost recovery for the people who really need the networking in there. Or they're going to partner with vendors or something like that.
So I'm working on a project right now which is building a data center. And as soon as the VMware licensing came out, the Wintel guys came down and said, right, we're moving to Zen. It wasn't even an issue. As far as they were concerned, the VMware pricing was so out of control, they switched straight over. And they didn't see any difference between VMware or Zen. And these were all hardened VMware people who'd spent 2 years skilling up. So I'm not sure that VMware's got a lock. They've got an ecosystem. They've got it in. But the thing is, here's the thing about the hypervisor, and I wrote about this during the week, is there are dozens of hypervisors. There's QBox, VirtualBox, Zen, KVM, Microsoft's Hyper-V, and they're just the major ones. There's another 15 or 20 in the wings of minor things. It's not hard to write a hypervisor in the modern environment. So VMware doesn't have something that nobody else has got. All they have is a first-to-market advantage, and they have an ecosystem advantage because of that, and they have management tools. I'm willing to bet that there's a whole bunch of VMware accessory makers, you know, people like Veeam and vKernel and, you know, all those people who hang their hat by producing utilities that hang off of vCenter are suddenly looking at it this week going, hang on, VMware isn't actually able to call the shots in the industry. We should possibly be thinking about not being dependent on VMware because, you know, Zen actually has a good product these days, and Microsoft is making some headway, and customers are seriously going elsewhere. And if EMC wants to tell VMware to drag more profit out of the organization, and they're not worried about what happens to customers in the meantime, there is, you know, the marketplace will adapt around that pretty quickly.
Yeah. Agreed.
I was surprised. I spoke to a number of VMware, like, customers in the last 2 weeks about it, and they just said, you know, it's fine. VMware's over there. We'll just build a Zen cluster over here and move on. That was the actual attitude I got. They weren't fully committed to VMware as the future. They just see it as a solution. And I'm sure there's other people out there who are totally committed to VMware. Don't get me wrong. But I've got a lot of, you know, interesting mix from different people. Anyway, the other thing I wanted to draw from that was that I personally, if you're going to introduce a usage-based licensing like VRAM, then give me another one which lets me buy it. Because there's... The VRAM thing means that you're starting to move it to bringing money out of OPEX, and there's an awful lot of companies out there who are still buying out of CAPEX who don't actually have an ability to buy IT out of OPEX because they have no OPEX. Everything's bought CAPEX. And I can't buy a VMware license and know that I'll own it for 5 years in a given form. I have to buy it every year. I have to VRAM up as my applications change and grow. And I don't believe that consumption-based licensing works for every business. And the shift for away from, you know, you buy it, you own it, to charging you by the mile for driving your car around in circles is not a desirable outcome. It may be something the industry wants in places, but there's equally people in the industry who don't. I don't want to rent a car and then pay by the mile for how much I use it. I want to own it and drive it around. All right, sorry. I'll climb off my hobby horse now.
No, I mean, that's actually true of us. In the educational environment, it's frequently true that you don't buy something and then think, oh, I can upgrade it later, because you never get the chance. So usually you totally oversize beyond proportion with the anticipation that, well, in a few years, because I don't get any maintenance windows, you know, it'll still be sized to support that. And that's – so I can definitely see that that would be a problem in our environment.
Yeah. Imagine going back to the professor of a given department and saying, yes, not only will you have to pay for us to install this, but you'll have to pay this much to keep it going every year. Yeah, he's not going to be happy about that. So moving on, this week Jeff Fry did an article this week about Nexus 7000 line cards. Jeff, why don't you tell us a little bit about what you discovered and how you did that?
Yeah, well, I was putting my kids to bed the one night, and I grabbed out the iPad with the old Cisco MIB on and just perusing through saying, okay, what's out there? And I came across all the racing names, actually, first for all the different line cards. Out like the Nürburgring for the 48-port copper card and everything else. Then as I kept looking down, I found a name called Osiris, and I'm like, what's this? And that kind of led me into the ASA and the NAM module and everything else. It's just one of those strange things you just do when you put your kids to bed, I guess.
Is anybody else disturbed by the fact that Jeff reads his kids SNMP MIBs and bedtime stories?
I think that is the nerdiest thing I think I've ever heard.
Daddy, read me another MIB. Please, Daddy.
I have issues. Those are my kids.
You know, Daddy, the checkpoint MIB always scares me.
So when you stand at the back window and yell out ASN.1.3.4.5.9.100.109.2, come here right now.
Oh, that's bad.
So what you found basically was that there's a whole bunch of modules coming that now particularly you saw that there's some Generation 2 fabric modules and some M2 line cards.
Yeah, I know I've heard of the M2s. I found some information on them. I think there was a reference to another line card coming. I forgot which one it was. There was a whole bunch of interesting stuff, though. I mean, firewall service module. If this doesn't start putting the writing on the wall for another Cisco switch, I don't know what does.
We always knew the service modules were coming, but it also has to be said that Cisco's delivery on service modules has been less than stellar. We were promised the ASA service module. It was announced 4 years ago. It was rumored. It was supposed to have been released 3 years ago, and yet it only delivered 3 months ago.
So it was delivered on time.
So anybody who's listening, don't hold your breath. The modules might be in the MIB, but there's a fair chance that Cisco's actually not going to produce them because they want to keep people buying the 6500. You can't tell. You can't make don't make a strategic decision in your company about it.
Well, I'm sure that the headcount churn that they've had in the last couple of weeks isn't going to help any of the shipping dates for some of their stuff, just because now the guys that are left, we have to consolidate them down and get them working on new projects. And how long did it take them to ship the Soup 2T?
Different. And, you know, the other question I have around Cisco's job layoffs is how many occurred in America and how many occurred in India, where the products are actually developed? But on that happy note, Alcatel-Lucent this week has also been having a grim time. The Register posted an article about the fact that Alcaloo is pondering the offload of its enterprise unit. Now, for those of you who don't have long memories, which is, why would you, is Alcatel was the final beneficiary of the Nortel Enterprise Business Unit, a.k.a. the ERS 8600, 5500, and so forth. Actually, not a bad switch, except for the fact that the software is not very good because it can't invest enough in it to make it stable. I certainly won't work on them very, very readily. Lots of good features, lots of good stuff. But now Alcatel Enterprise is attempting to flog the unit off to somebody. Not a good look for the Nortel stuff, which is technically pretty good kit, except for some, just needs some love and a home to, that's going to treat it right, then it could actually do quite well. And anybody
who,
else?
Who'd want it, though? That's the thing. I mean, who looks at that and goes, this is filling a niche. This is the stuff that I need, that I wanted. I mean, it was Nortel. It became Alcatel-Lucent, and it just, who's really, in the enterprise space, who's an Alcatel customer? I think there's some play over in Europe. Certainly not much in North America that I've heard about. It seems like it's Alcatel is still what I associate with carrier stuff as far as where they really make their bread and butter.
I'm sorry, I fell asleep when you said Alcatel.
So did Alcatel.
It's probably one of those deals where they're shopping for a buyer, and the people who have the big players, if they don't already make their own stuff, they've already snapped up all the little fish that they can to create that business. And so they're just looking to offload it because they need the cash to hopefully close out some investors and be done with it.
I mean, who do you look at as someone out there who wants a switch to add to their portfolio? IBM came to my mind. I mean, Dell obviously just bought Force 10, so who's left? Who are the big players that, IBM and who else?
You're running pretty thin, and of the ones that are left that could use it, what, Brocade? I mean, Brocade lost 25% of their business on Thursday and Friday. Their stock got flushed down the toilet. It's like $3 and change now. Mm. So, I mean, they're not going to be buying anything.
As always, HP.
That's right. You know they won't drop any products off the product list. The only other question is, do they have any interesting patents or anything that's actually worth buying and dropping the product line? But
There may be one, and Josh may be keen to it, the Genesys platform for routing and call center space. That's a big competitor to Cisco ICM, if I understand it correctly.
Genesys is actually an interesting thing that you brought that up, but we're seeing it stripped out of a lot of places. They've actually tried to talk to us, but it's the whole issue of, again, video for us. I wanted to ask the question, though, around Nortel. Somebody else owns all those patents now, so what's the real benefit of taking the enterprise business when somebody else owns all the IP? That was part of that whole big Microsoft land grab and stuff from Google not long ago.
And the enterprise unit got its own IP. That was everything else to do with carrier and LTE.
Okay.
So Nortel had a big carrier division that had a whole bunch of sort of like fundamental patents around mobile technologies and mobile workflows and things like that. The EB, the enterprise business unit, still owns, well, they don't have too many patents anyway. I mean, around the enterprise stuff, because most of it's open standards, OSPF, you know, RIP. MPLS isn't exactly, you know, too much intellectual property around that sort of space. True. Now, it's just a shame, really, because the product is quite good. It's got good chance, and I must say that the old Nortel business unit had great engineers. They just lacked a certain amount of execution stuff. So I do hope that Alcatel does, decide what it's going to do with it pretty soon and make it possible for that product to keep going. But Brocade also this week had a 20% share drop on Thursday, Friday. They announced lower numbers, and there's a lot of ripe speculation about what's going to happen to Brocade. There was a halt as they announced their numbers significantly lower than they expected. So Brocade doesn't look to be in good shape either. I was chatting to somebody during the week about Brocade and to what its future looked like, and I was told that Brocade is a hard thing to sell. It's not like they could have sold Brocade to Dell, because a lot of Brocade's revenue comes from its OEM relationships with companies like Hay Products. You know, EMC does a lot of deals with Brocade. If Brocade was to go to a vendor, IBM, then everybody else would buy Brocade and numbers would fall out of the floor. So there are some questions being raised as to whether Brocade can survive alone, and even if it was to be acquired, would it survive as well? So I don't know if anybody's looking at Brocade, or, you know, they've got a good story around their VCS, even if it is a little bit early, but, you know, interesting to see what happens there.
I wonder if this isn't a backlash from the whole Dell acquisition of Force 10, because, I mean, the whole industry knew that Dell was going to buy Brocade. That was the whole story, and then all of a sudden they come out and they buy a cheaper, better fit for them, and now Brocade's kind of like the girl that didn't get asked to the dance, and so she's sulking off in the corner and doesn't want to talk to anybody now. And so maybe if it does get snapped up by a vendor, like, you know, hey, IBM doesn't have anything right now, maybe that will hasten the end of Fibre Channel if nobody wants to buy it anymore. because we can't get our adapters cheap from.
I believe Brocade's big on selling its 16 gig fiber channel. It's desperate to get it off the ground to try and get some revenue through the door.
And maybe that's what the
problem
is. Customers
aren't very interested in.
They poured so much R&D into 16 gig fiber channel, which is a product that nobody really is asking for right now, that they, you know, forgot to say, hey, we're in the business of selling equipment.
Hard to know. I hope something does come along to look for, especially for the people who work there. You know, those companies do have some good products, but it's a tough time in the industry. I want to throw the floor out to Mrs. Wynow as our resident security princess, you know, in a community of security princesses, of course. And tell us a little bit about what came out of Black Hat this week.
Some interesting things. I was more impressed by the overhyped stuff, or what I perceived to be overhyped, than the actual, you know, good information that came out that didn't get as much attention. I mean, you know, everybody's talking about war texting and GSM hacking again, you know, and how that impacts SCADA. One guy even was talking about, one guy made a presentation about hacking his insulin equipment that automatically, he spent 2 years hacking his own device that automatically gives him insulin, and he was successful in that.
Like you do. Yeah. I mean, that's the first thing I thought of.
You know, so SCADA was, you know, the big topic, as usual. I saw this ISSA post, and they were talking about big data being used in security for analysis, and that's been talked about a lot, you know, huge rainbow tables, huge statistical analysis. I know a guy who did, I think it's PDF X-ray or something, and it analyzes PDF hacking, you know, compromised trends. So it's, I think they're using big data and data warehousing in the same way that the rest of the industry has been using it, but now they're using it for security. And I think Operation Shady Rat comes out of that. You know, McAfee made this big disclosure about all these organizations that got pwned by APT. But, you know, then Symantec and Sophos said, well, yeah, where's the news in that? It was more, I think, a publicity stunt than anything. They did the same thing at RSA this past year as well. You know, look what we found. You know, all these foreign entities have been infiltrating our public and private sector. Is that news, really?
Based on my experience with that product, they're probably just happy they found anything.
Well, they did this. They took public data. The Symantec Post said they took, Symantec actually analyzed the data as well, and they discovered that it wasn't very advanced. So is, you know, saying that you have a group, by saying, attributing it to one specific group like this, and saying they're organized and everything like that, it seems a little bit like blaming things on the boogeyman now. You know, oh, it's Lulz. Oh, it's Anonymous. It's everything is perpetuated by this, you know, group who they're really smart. It's like saying, you know, when people have all these paranoid fantasies about the NSA and everything and the government, U.S. government, you know, infiltrating all your communications and everything. I mean, if you know anything about the federal government, you know that they can't even talk to each other. How are they going to be smart enough to figure out and filter every single call and know everything that's going on? They can't even share information or figure out how to talk to each other.
Sounds a lot like the RSA stuff. Remember the advanced persistent threat boogeyman that hacked us and everything.
Then Microsoft is now paying rewards for they're paying bounties, which is big news. You know, and the big facial recognition. I think I posted something about this. There was a guy who came out and he said that you could use a facial recognition technology and combine it with searches on names and doing links with everything to violate privacy and get social security numbers. You know, nobody, I haven't seen the or anything that'll come out in a couple of weeks. it reminded me of a Better Off TED episode where Viridian Dynamics comes out with a similar technology, which came out a couple of years ago. So it was really kind of – that was probably the most interesting thing. That and apparently some OSPF exploit, which Kurt and I talked about it. And we can't figure out what the exploit is because they said, oh, well, if you pwn the router and you get the secret that's on the router, then you can get into you can mess with OSPF and get into other routers.
Odds are good if you already own the router, you can get into OSPF and start screwing with it anyway.
Right. Well, Kurt, did you?
Well, my understanding of it was that I didn't read too much into it other than a couple of articles, but the big thing I saw was if you have an OSPF router and another device talking OSPF sends some LSAs, they'll make it into my LSADB. And I'm like, yes, that's what the protocol does. I mean,
you guys read Jeff Doyle.
Yeah, I mean, you might be able to make
This is sweet. The exploit requires one compromised router, so the encryption key used for LSA traffic among the routers can be lifted and used by the phantom router. So somebody has to put a router in the network, B, know the encryption key so they can decode it, and then if you could inject an LSA, you could corrupt the network. That's how OSPF works.
Yeah, right. I that's what I didn't understand. I'm thinking, wait a second. I posted stuff and I started emailing people and I went, you know, I'm no OSPF expert, but, you know, if I pwn a Unix box and I have root, then I can, you know, compromise all the passwords and everything else. Well, okay, yeah. Isn't that the point?
But I think the thing is
that's like saying you can hack an SSL site if you've got the private key.
Right.
But I think you only need to hack the router if they're using encryption, right? Obvious, like using authentication on the link. If they're not using authentication, then you can just peer up and do whatever you want. But I still don't see it as an exploit because it's OSPF doing OSPF.
Right, and if you're not using authentication, I mean, you know.
Yeah, well.
All right, we're done. Move on. Who cares? Losers.
Yeah, it's funny because I did post that and nobody really – I said, you know –
Here's the thing. This is where the security industry shoves itself up the ass with a 9-inch tool, though.
Are you?
I mean –
This is going up
the
okay.
So it's sort of like saying, look, there's an elephant in the room. I've got elephant repellent. I can keep you safe. Right? Well, when you get trampled by an elephant, right – you don't sit there and say the elephant repellent didn't work, do you? Nobody cares, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the problems with the security. I think there are so many security cons now that sometimes I think I emailed somebody, one of the managers for a group sent that article about the OSPF vulnerability. You know, I'm going to use the air quotes, the packet pushers air quotes here. And, you know, I said to him, you know, I think the CFP for some of these conferences scrape the bottom of the barrel a little bit because some of these are just, they build on other stuff. You know, they're not that, yes, okay, well, you're saying you can mess with OSPF if you have, if you got the secret key and you're, you know, you're part of the infrastructure. I mean,
we call that administration.
It's because all the smart hackers are sitting at home keeping their mouths shut and using these exploits to make money. They're not going to Black Hat and talking about it.
That's right. If Black Hat, anybody can get out. Maybe the OSPF thing was something that the journalists could understand, and that's why it turned into something. But sometimes that happens. The really deep technical stuff doesn't get on the air because the person who's writing about it can't turn it into a story. You know, somebody who writes occasionally, I have to sit down and listen to a company present about something. And then you have to sit there and go, there's just no way I can put that into a 750-word article that's going to be printed. So, you know, if you say you can hack OSPF, that's easy. You can whip off a post in, you know, 90 minutes and you'll be away. And that's what you've got to watch out for when you're reading this stuff. I wanted to come back to this Operation Shady Rat, and you were talking about how people are using data to hack security. Beaker is a guy who's just joined Juniper security team, and he tweeted during the week that the idea of using Hadoop clusters to actually do security analysis is taking off, and that's going to be the next big thing for log munging.
Yeah, I think that's awesome because, you know, if anybody has dealt with logs much, I mean, in my former Unix career and even networking and the size of our network and the amount of traffic that goes through it, I mean, it's just phenomenal. So, yeah, the idea that you'd use Hadoop and that would be – that's the only way you can start to, like, find patterns and actually accomplish anything, I think, with the amount of logs that an organization like ours has.
It's the only way you're going to manage it, because you're going to need that sort of correlation of data to make it work.
Yeah.
All right, enough security. I'm getting bored. Security always sends me to sleep after a certain amount of time. So there's only so much security I can take. I mean, firewalls are good enough, right? But, you know, I mean, talking of security, I had a thing this week. I've got to get a new accounting package for my company. And, you know, you cannot buy for love nor money an accounting package that exists on your desktop. The only accounting package you can buy is from some cloud provider who gives it to you in a web interface that you have to rent every – you have to pay X $20, £20 a month to have a subscription to. And you go and check out their security and it's a miserable, miserable thing. But nobody's making any accounting software for the desktop. You just can't find small business software that you can actually buy and own and keep secure. Why isn't the security industry doing something about that? That'd be
useful. Because it's not sexy. I mean, it's the same reason why nobody can build a good, decent SIM that's somewhat easily implemented. Because nobody – it's just not – we waste a lot of time on, ooh, look at this advanced persistent threat. When we don't do the proactive stuff in the beginning, recovery stuff – I mean, security is supposed to be about BCDR. I don't hear a lot of security people talk about it. Too busy going to security cons a lot of times. I mean, it's a little disheartening. I mean, I get tired of it too, because it was kind of an afterthought for me. I got sort of pigeonholed into the security part of networking, and I feel – sometimes I just feel very frustrated. I get – you know, by the last day of a security conference, I'm just done. You know, it's like, okay, but how are you going to fix it?
When I started consulting, I focused a lot on security, and – I found a couple things. One, it's a giant culture of no. When you try to consult with inside organizations and work with people and try to actually make headway and do the things you need to do, it's no, 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 no. That's not policy. And I run into it more and more and more now that I'm dealing with clients and their security side from a vendor perspective. But the other aspect of it is I just don't think a lot of security guys, and this could be way reaching, have any clue how to even start going about these threats. They buy toys, and they buy toys, and they buy toys. And the toys that are out there to try to do security are, like Mrs. White just said, they're the sexy things, the things that can make money for a company, the things that look like they're the big gotchas, yet we're doing things like not protecting banks as in-depth as we should, and we're not protecting our accounting data, and we're not protecting – you know, the critical business data. It scares the crap out of me.
I mean, that means sitting down and so they separate it out into the compliance and information assurance people, and they're usually not as technically savvy and as some of the actual security engineers. And
yeah,
so you've
you put
got
that
the separation.
Very politely.
Yeah, and you've got this total separation, and so when they, you know, when they're auditing firewall rules, they don't have a real understanding, the people who are doing the auditing and compliance stuff. So, but the other guys don't seem as interested in, you know, going – because as good as you get with parsing logs, and that's what's so interesting about the Hadoop thing and big data, is that there's still a lot of manual process right now going on. It's still like a mechanical Turk, and you got to go through that the logs and alerting and everything, and you got to sort of get a feel for what's a false positive. And they just, in a lot of cases, I don't know, I'm not finding that, I mean, it is overwhelming, I admit it, but I'm not seeing, you know, why aren't SIMs improving? That was supposed to be, you know, the no-brainer, the thing that was going to save our organizations, but they haven't.
Yeah, we still have people running checkpoint firewalls with Smart Defense turned off because every time they turn it on, it breaks.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the limit of competency of an awful lot of security people is, you know, and they spend a lot of time over the compliance and the processing of a security rule instead of saying, actually, as long as we've got some sort of control at the edge, the rest of it's all logging and monitoring and digging for data, digging for patterns and user patterns. And, you know, the greatest threat is internally. What are your internal staff doing that you can't see? Especially in big organizations where the security guy's not sitting next to the networking guy and the server guy and knowing what he's doing.
I think the biggest question they ask is, are we compliant? As long as the answer is yes, they're happy.
Yeah.
Well, that's the only downside. Although Sony found out to their loss, of course, because with their recent, you know, pattern of attacks and vulnerabilities and their data loss, and it's certainly going to affect their bottom line. And then we're going to see some analysis coming out from the companies who give IT insurance. So there are companies in America who, I don't have a link for this, they're just stories that I was listening to or read. There are companies suing their banks for losing half a million to $1 million small businesses. And what happened was somebody actually hacked their account, threw the password, and then stole it. And they're saying, but that's the bank's responsibility. And the bank's saying, it's not our responsibility. They had your password. And the law is actually unclear, and it's actually only now being set. And with Sony's failures, the question is, what did they do? You know, what should they have done better? And are their insurance company going to pay up? Because if their insurance company isn't going to pay up for the security breach, then Sony has then got a capital value about how it's going to take, how much business did it lose. Or if the insurance company has to pay up, then insurance premiums are going to set the price of security going forward, because they're only going to say, we'll insure you if you conform to this standard. And the insurance companies will be actually quite good at setting standards that actually work, because they've got real money riding on it. All right. One other thing that happened this week is that the Cisco VPN client, as we all know and love since about, I don't know, 1922, has been end-of-lifed. Is anybody still using the old Cisco VPN client?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Guilty.
Guilty.
Yeah, I mean, it's free. It's functional, and it just works across a variety of platforms. But Cisco definitely wants us to go towards
AnyConnect.
Towards AnyConnect, absolutely. That's the direction they're pushing us to. And AnyConnect does solve a few problems, things like swapping over to a backup VPN in the background without requiring user interaction. But they're licensing that. Yeah. That's a cost. You've got to license the ASA to support however many AnyConnect connections you need. I think you can get two out of the box just so you can, you know, get a taste of it. And the first one's always free, right? And then... Right. Somebody was saying earlier in the conversation, was it you, Greg? Something like $40,000 for 500 licenses, list U.S.
That's
dollars,
right, yeah.
Something like that. Yeah, it's definitely not cheap to move to AnyConnect. So it seems like Cisco's maybe going to strong arm us all into going to AnyConnect, whether we like it or not.
Yeah, that's right. We can always go to Junos Pulse.
It's the same thing. You still have to have that license. They still, yeah, Juniper does. Cisco's actually just, they saw that Juniper was making money that way, and everybody else. Mm-hmm. I mean, how many people have SSL VPNs? And really, Juniper does like a hybrid. It's SSL VPN and ESP with Network Connect. And AnyConnect can do the same thing. It's now supporting IPsec. But it's, again, that license. They know that they've got us over the barrel, and they, that's how we make the money. And, but there are also some issues we have with the way they do profiles and stuff like that. And we're going to have to change a lot of our configurations to use it. It's going to be a little painful for us because we weren't really – we were doing some strange things with our IPsec, the old client, and the way we used profiles to segregate people, which was kind of silly, but –
Maybe that's the problem. I've been told that the cost of supporting the old IPsec client, because it comes off an old code base, and they didn't want to rewrite the IPsec client to make it compatible with the current generation of Windows. And this is their third attempt to kill off the old client.
Really?
This isn't the first time they've tried to. The first one was when 5 years ago they said we're not going to make it 32-bit. It had a whole bunch of 16-bit stuff. And then 2 years ago, they said we're not going to take it to 64-bit, but the outcry was pretty deep. And so they wrote the 64-bit IPsec VPN client eventually for Windows 7, but didn't backport it to any of the old versions. And now they're saying that's it. It's AnyConnect or nothing, and, yep, don't forget to pay. Yeah, hold the key, because Uncle John's struggling. You know, we need more money.
Maybe they finally got rid of it by getting rid of the guy who maintained the code base.
Maybe what comes out of this, the end of life for the IPsec client, is that there's going to be a free flavor of AnyConnect that's feature limited. And if you want the one that actually does all the cool stuff, then you got to pay up. Be interesting to one of the reasons that we ended up with ASA instead of Checkpoint at my current employer was because to go with Checkpoint and get everything licensed up so we could do the VPN design that we wanted was going to cost a fortune. Hey, we can just install ASAs, which we can get really cheap, and the IPsec client costs us nothing. It's just however many licenses or licenses for the particular ASA we want to terminate these tunnels on. It saved us many, many, many thousands of dollars, so that's the direction we went. Now if they take that away, all of a sudden Cisco's opening the door for a competitor to step in and say, I got a great VPN solution. What do you say?
The other driver might be, though, AnyConnect is more platform universal, like iPad, iPods, Macs.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, where the AnyConnect was other one was kind of just Windows, or that's about the only client I really knew of.
Solaris, and they actually had Linux.
And I run the Mac one.
But you can see where the AnyConnect has got a lot more universal to it for any type of platform because of how it works with Java and stuff. That we all love that.
You say that like it's an advantage.
Yeah.
Come on, Google's going to love Java in a little bit, aren't they?
Yeah.
No one else is going to.
Yeah.
I think Oracle's going to do a pretty good job of destroying that product by the time they get to version 8, because version 7 is well on the road to making everybody hate it.
Well, I think, not to sidetrack, I saw Oracle was going to go after Google for the use of the Java on the Android phones.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I saw that. They're going to really... I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen to Android with all this. But they basically Tech World or something came out with this amazing article today about they used what was that movie with Daniel Day-Lewis? They were comparing There Will Be Blood, it's just there's this industry Schadenfreude for Google. You know, just everybody, they were citing all these examples of how different organizations hated them and just wanted them to be destroyed. So
sometimes if you're big, you just become a target by virtue of somebody once described it to me as when you're an elephant, sometimes even when you take a step back, you stand on a mouse, even when the mouse is your friend. You don't mean to, but you do. And sometimes Google's made a few mistakes on the basis that when they did something, they accidentally took somebody out and made some enemies, and it's just starting to get to that point now. I'm not really all that bothered about it. I don't think Android's going to last for long, and I think you're going to see the rise of WebOS. I think the patent uncertainty around Android will probably drive WebOS into the fore, and HP would like to see WebOS become the corporate platform of choice. Of course, Cisco with their CS would like to see it become the corporate platform of choice. But I don't think they've got, compared to the WebOS or tablet, I don't think they've got much chance.
Well, Cirrus is what, Android, Tom?
Yeah, it's running a customized version of Android that has a whole bunch of Cisco stuff built into the back of it, which is a nice way of saying we need to have time to make it corporate ready before we push it out to you, so don't expect to be on the cutting edge anytime soon.
Well, Tom, you've actually got your CS working now, haven't you, the one that you got at Cisco Live?
It's making phone calls, yes. part of the problem is that they're supposed to have a release code out shortly, and I haven't seen that release code yet. So I'm still kind of wondering,
Because you're the sum total population of users?
He's the sum total population of every Cisco booth at Cisco Live.
It's one of those things where you basically get a pre-release unit, and you're like, oh, this is going to be really cool. And then you're waiting and you're waiting and you're waiting for stuff to come out for it.
Is that why you got the tattoo?
Yeah. They made me get the tattoo in order to get the CS or something like that.
That could be a collector's item in the future. There's only, five of them sold and you've got one. Like baseball cards, but...
Or the Apple Newton.
I had a Newton. Oh, I couldn't do a thing with it, but I had one.
Conference for motion picture, television, and something engineers the other week. And they had a display of all this ancient technology, and they had an Apple Newton message pad.
God.
Along with Betamax recorders and stuff. It was kind of humorous. Dot, dot, dot.
All of which get edited out.
Jeff, I've got a question for you. I'm run up against a problem on some Nexus 2000s in a network design. And you know how the Nexus 2000s are actually sort of parasitically booted from the neighboring unit, be it a 5000 or a 7000, right, as a fabric extender?
Mm-hmm.
If you reboot the 5000 or the 7000, do the 2000s go down as well?
Good question. I haven't had a chance to do that yet.
I think the answer to that is no, because back in the day when I was shopping for those, there is a way to configure them where they are multi-home, with effects as multi-home to two 7,000s or 5,000s, as the case may be.
I think you can do the multi-homing with 5s, but not the 7s, if I remember correctly.
That might be true, yeah.
I think the split brain works on the 5Ks, because they don't do, I think it was the VPCs and everything else get all messed up.
Yeah, that's the problem, is you can't. Yeah, you can't do VPCs between split chassis on 2000s then.
Right.
So you can't have 40 gig uplinks or 80 gig uplinks. And they actually recommend you to actually single home them as a fabric in the same way that storage fabrics are designed.
On the 7K, right? Or even the 5s.
Well,
the 5s are in split.
Yeah, when the Cisco rep was explaining it to me, going through the different configurations, when we got to multi-homing the FEXs to different... at that point, only 5,000s were even capable of supporting the faxes. The 7,000s weren't on the board yet. But he got all hemmed and hawed and kind of like, you can do it, but, you know, really, and it seemed to be directing you back to the single home solution for the faxes. And for redundancy, then, stick two faxes in your as a top of rack and, you know, spread your servers across that, and seemed to be more what they wanted you to do.
Yeah, LECP from the server through the...
Yeah, yeah.
And the faxes become sort of like a fancy active cable.
Mm-hmm.
Back to the 5,000. Yeah, that's what I thought.
So buy more is our strategy, right? Buy more Nexus and more Nexus.
Well, the Nexus 2000 is kind of like justifying why the 5,000 and 7,000 is so expensive, I think, rather than anything particularly. It's a very difficult product to describe verbally. You have to have a whiteboard and a bunch of diagrams to work it through, I think.
When they first came out, I was deep, deep in the data center stuff, and I deployed 3 data centers with them. The last one before I made my transition was the biggest, and we did the single homing and all that. And it's an interesting product because the whole centralized management thing, and we talk about, you know, trying to get data centers more and more to a central operation mode. But there's just a lot of weird little complexity issues with them that I don't know that I wouldn't just go with normal top of rack switches if I had to design my own data center out. It would have to be, you know, some real look at the cash behind it, but I'm not totally sold on the FEX concept at this point.
Well, the other thing is the FEXs are nice, but running them to a regular, running a VM cluster right to a 5K or 7K gives you a lot more advantages and benefits, I think, especially when you start talking the vSwitch architecture within the VM stuff. I just don't trust that stuff yet.
Absolutely. And then when you start looking at other vendor stuff, so you start looking at the old Cisco switches, even in, say, the old C7000s, there's some really weird things that you have to do to make them work and make them work correctly, just some protocol issues between them. So the FEX is, like I said, I think there's some cost-saving things, but I think there's a lot more benefit, like Jeff was saying, just to go to the 5Ks or 7Ks.
Yeah, because if you run the power connects or anything else in those chassis, you kind of lose the east-west switching functionality because you got to run them in pass-through.
Yeah, that's right.
So, I mean, it's just easier to go with a smarter switch upstream. I think the 5Ks, the 2Ks are nice for some scenarios where you have a whole bunch of servers or just little stuff. But as you go more into the virtualization, it just starts not to make any more sense.
Well, I found it very confusing at the moment. I'm looking at the MK81R VM FEX adapter on the Cisco UCS servers, where they're actually extending the fabric. They're coming up with a FEX idea and extending it all the way into the NIC adapters on the server blades. And it's just mapping the pathways out is actually getting really quite complicated.
UCS, I feel a little bit different about. UCS and the entire FEX concept there is an entire backplane and how that can scale out. I think that's a whole different concept than the 2000s. And when you start mapping that stuff, I agree, it can be a little bit complex, but there's some huge power that you can get when you start being able to define that backplane and how it's mapping and how it's going up northbound.
But it could be really interesting if you plug the MK81R, then plug that into your UCS6100, and you're actually then from the UCS6100 configuring the VNICs, or the you're configuring the physical NIC in the server into multiple virtual NICs, which then get presented to VMware's virtual NICs as autonomous units. And at that point, it sort of gets a bit recursive. It just doesn't work verbally at all, does it? But anyway, those of you who research this topic will know exactly. So there is that. One topic I wanted to raise is that somebody had a blog post this week, Judd over at chainringcircus.org, and he posted a blog post where he said he had a guy that he's working with, and they had a problem. And the guy he was working with was hitting the Google trying to find an answer. So he said, I went straight to the man page and started working on problems. My coworker went straight to Google. He said, in 2 hours, I'd read the man page and worked out a solution, and the guy who was on Google was off watching YouTube. The answer isn't, and he made a point, the answer isn't always on Google. Sometimes you have to read the manuals. So you have to go to the Cisco documentation website or the Juniper website. You know, even though their documentation's still hidden behind secret paywalls, you still have to sign in to get access to it. Same with Brocade. You know, you have to go to the and read the manuals to find the source of the problem. Googling for an answer isn't always going to work, especially for deep tech stuff. I mean, does anybody else use Google? Or
I use Google on occasion for things, but for instance, I was looking at an issue regarding trying to set up two parallel IPsec tunnels heading back to two different. So if an ASA firewall is a hub or a spoke, I'm trying to go to two different hubs with the same traffic that would be carried by both IPsec tunnels. Long story short, it's a real pain in the rear end to do it. I couldn't figure out from the manual, which was just about hopeless from Cisco, how to do it, although I read all the chapters and so on that were related. They just don't talk about the topic. So finally, I ended up on Google, and there really wasn't much discussion about it there. You get hits on forums and this and that. Someone might write a blog post that's kind of related. But a lot of times what you get out there, you got to question the source. You know, is it any good? Is the information that you're reading trustworthy and reliable, relevant to the operating system or the code level that you're running and so on? So it's, yeah, I reflexively go to the instruction manual first in Google or Twitter or G+, if the instruction manual has failed me.
I'll sometimes go to Google just to try to get a direction as to where to look, and then maybe go back to the Cisco pages or whatever to try to dig into that section. Because sometimes just not even looking at the blog post on Google, you can get an idea, oh, these are the people talking about a similar feature, and try to help direct me. It doesn't always work, but it does help me give some direction at times, instead of me just trying to figure it out and relate to what it could actually be and where to go look.
I totally agree. And I've been saying for years, both when I was a young engineer and learning, and also to a lot of the engineers who I've, you know, kind of helped bring up, including my staff now, we're probably not the first people to ever do this. There's probably somebody else someplace who's done this. And if a quick 2-minute search can help put us in that right direction, that's great. The bad thing is, the business I'm living in now, as I continue to point out, that there is no video call center world at this point. We are finding we are the first people doing a couple things, and that gets really dicey because we end up living on the phone with support lines a whole lot. So real quickly, we go beyond Docs, beyond Google, beyond what I can pull up on Twitter and everything else. And now I'm just sitting on the phone for hours and hours and hours with BU people through TAC.
I had the same experience as Josh. In my last job, I was an operations manager for a wireless ISP. And when you're one of like 20 or 30 companies in the world that have deployed this technology, and you call the vendor and the vendor goes, oh, that's cute.
I've heard that.
No. But, and the instruction manuals are terribly poor. Like you're looking at the show output, for example, and it's got something that's called a Michael error. And the information in the instructions say Michael error, the count of Michael errors.
Yes. Oh, stuff like that happens. Technical writers out there that might be listening to this show, both of you, please explain to the engineer types like us why, what that actually means and how we're supposed to react to it. Give us our options and explain to us, in this scenario, you would use this command, and it was written for this reason. This is why you use it, how you plug it in. Not just, like Kurt was saying, not the obvious. We get that. We knew that. We could have written that. We want help. We want a guidance so that we don't have to call TAC.
but the other thing is that man pages have considerably less kittens in them, so Google's always worth it for something.
The two reasons to never learn to rely on Google is, one, you may be troubleshooting a problem in front of a customer, and if you pull up Google to find the answer, they're going to start looking at you like, well, I could have done that. Two, you could be troubleshooting a problem where you don't have internet access, and if all you know how to do is search Google and you can't read the 3,000-page manual that someone printed out and laid on the desk beside the device, you're probably going to get stuck.
Yeah. There's also a case to be made for good Google searching, so using things like site:cisco.com to search Cisco's website, because it's infinitely better than using Cisco search, and you know, learning how to compound search terms like, you know, IPsec and BGP, and you know, and get them all and say, I only want to see pages that have these compoundings of things. And of course, if you are going to work on a particular vendor's website, then understand how they lay it out. Like, for example, the Bluecoat website is laid out in a really odd way. But once you sort of grok the idiocy that they sort of used to formulate the basis of that website, you can sort of pretty quickly move around to find the things that you need to find, right? And Cisco website is just so massive that it's disorganized inherently. It's not. It's just so much of it.
Yeah, there's so much of it. They change it regularly, and then they don't fix their links in other parts. So you find an article you want at the bottom, click here for more information. You click there, you get a 404, and you're done. Cisco site is uniquely frustrating to me in that regard.
I think you made a really good point about the whole searching correctly on Google too, and making sure you're doing things for years and years and years in consulting. I'd have an engineer yell across the cube, "How do you do this?" And four or five people would jump for manuals or start expounding on their great experience. And 30 seconds later, I'd email them a link from "Let me Google that for you." And it would be the answer to what they're looking for right on Cisco's site. And people continuously are like, well, one, we hate when you send us "Let me Google that for you" links because it's, you know, snotty. And I said, yes, you're right. It's funny. but more to the point, it's like you guys can sit here and expound all you want and go to these books that were written 4 years ago. And I can probably have it with the right search through the right materials through, you know, Cisco or Juniper or whoever else pretty quickly. So
Google that answer and then go make them find it. Stand over their shoulder and go, okay, it's there. I know it is. Why don't you go look for it and I'll teach you how to Google search.
They were usually senior engineers and they just bored me, so I kept moving on.
Yeah, I thought it was a good – I just felt that was a particularly inspiring post because it was pointing out that, you know, not everything in the world is efficient the way that you might expect it to be. So
it's just a matter of how you use the tools.
All right. Has anybody else got any topics to give us or any topics you want to raise for the peanut gallery?
Has anybody looked at the new firmware and features for the Nexus 7000 yet with the MPLS and the FCOE? I'm just curious to know if anyone has an opinion on that.
It's too shiny.
Yeah. Now, the FCOE looks interesting. I mean, they were talking a lot about that at Cisco Live. Because I think to get that, you actually get another VDC on your switch. You get a storage VDC, which
that's
is definitely...
Cool.
There was also talk about, what do they call it, 4+1 VDC? Because you get four VDCs today, including your management, but they're talking about breaking out the management VDC to a +1. So you actually get four switches, then have a separate management network admin switch instead of having to share it with a production VDC, which is a kind of nice thought. So you'll get that, then the storage VDC will be one of those that you can use. But I think you have to have the F card to do, that's the one that does the fiber channel, to do the storage VDC stuff. That's, I don't know if that's in the 5.2, that's in the next train of code that comes out, the storage VDC. Might be in this one. I haven't had a chance to dig into it.
If you figure that you're building a brand new data center and you're looking at buying a Cisco MDS 9500, 92, you know, like a director class switch.
You think you still need it. I don't think the Nexus is a director class.
That's interesting. Why not?
I just think it's a pass-through switch right now. I think everything I saw with the storage stuff showed an MDS upstream.
So it's
a document.
So it's continuing to be part of the multi-hop FCOE structure. It's not really designed to control FCOE. It's meant to be more of a pseudo-wire type thing.
Yeah, take your FCOE taken from your server and stuff.
Okay.
You would plug your server directly in there via 10 gig, do a Ether channel down with split storage off and split Ethernet off, and then it would pass the FCOE backup or the fiber channel backup stream then.
And this is where I think FCOE fails. I think this is they've come along with this great shiny technology and told everybody that FC is going to go away and that they're going to be able to do converged cable and all these other things, and then we still need director class devices. I think it's the biggest injustice that Cisco's done to their own product or to a new standard is to say we're not going to put products out there that are capable of replacing what was legacy. And that's also why I don't think FCOE is the winning technology in the end.
I think FCOE has a place, especially once 40 gig and 100 gig hit, though. It's not going to make a lot of sense to have a whole bunch of cabling.
Well, the thing is that fiber Ethernet is already more efficient than fiber.
Well, I think we're going to call that a show, so why don't we wrap it up? Now, Mrs. Y had to take off a little early. The Black Hat guys heard her talking, and she got a phone call, and the next poof, she was gone, so she had to take off. The rest of us that are here are gonna wrap it up and say goodbye. Kurt from Australia, where it's, what is it now, about 4:30 in the morning, something like that?
That's about that, yes.
You, what you got planned for the week, sir?
Couple more reports. My boss is getting married in a couple of weeks, so I'm planning his bucks party for next weekend. So if you don't hear from me after this week, something bad happened. But other than that, still playing with some Cisco Metro switches in the DC just for something different. And getting back onto my CCIE studies. So lots of work.
Jeff, thanks for joining us this week and talking Nexus and all the other stuff that you brought to the table. What's on your plans this week?
It's budget time for us to start getting ready for next year, and I have to get ready to upgrade a pair of Cat OS, which is to iOS, in about 2.5 weeks.
Good luck with that. Yeah, I hope it goes well.
Thanks.
A little reminder that technology never dies.
What do we hear?
And Josh O'Brien, what are you in your plans? You're on vacation now, right?
Yeah, we're wrapping that up, and I'm at a client site on Monday, and then we're driving back to Ohio, and then I get to continue to play vendor ping pong with vendors lying to me about what they can do with video call centers over the next couple of weeks, and hopefully find one who can actually hold true to it. So that's my week.
Holding a vendor to, okay. And Tom Hollingsworth, what does the week hold for you?
Oh, the week holds all kinds of excitement. We are now in crunch time. The area schools are getting ready to start back up, and so now everyone wants their stuff done before school starts. So I'm going to be working on 3 different phone systems next week and writing some voice-related blog posts on my blog at networkingnerd.net and venting all of my frustrations on my Twitter feed as @networkingnerd. So please feel free to read them. If you don't feel like blocking me at the end of the week, I'll consider it a major win.
And Greg, you're phoning this in from the hotel where the connection has been difficult at best. And what's your week hold?
I've got strings of meetings to lock down a detailed design. I actually had a look at the word count yesterday and got a bit of a fright, 75,000 words, when I realized that is also the same size as a typical novel. It's only when you think about it like that, you realize how much you write some days. And that's why I haven't been blogging much at etherealmind.com, but I have had these little eructations of consciousness on Twitter, and you can also find me on Google+. Where I've actually been popping up little random thoughts.
And I am Ethan Banks. You can follow me on Twitter at ecbanks. And I am blogging over at packetpushers.net now, where any of the new content, the new articles going forward that I write are going to show up there. And this has been a fun show for us to record. Recording challenges, lots of people, and lots of laughs. And we hope you enjoyed it. Have a great week, everybody. We'll see you later.